Here I am, ba-da, ba-da, rock me like a Herman Cain. Peas, 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 eating goober peas. Goodness, how delicious, eating goober peas. We love the goober peas, don't we, folks? We love to eat a goober pea. It's the best. You go, you take them, you put them in your mouth. You march through Georgia with your goober peas. If anyone remembers that. They probably don't. That was a Civil War marching song about peanuts. That's how unentertained people were back there. They had to sing songs about goddamn peanuts. How sad. Can you imagine? How bizarre. How bizarre. So today we're going to talk about the first chapter of Reconstruction. But before we start, just do a little, how you doing, everybody? Don't worry. If anybody didn't do the reading, it's no big deal. The first chapter is mostly setting the stage. It starts with the Emancipation Proclamation, the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation. And it's essentially focuses on the way that the Civil War had broken apart American society. How it was exposing and intensifying friction points between elements of the social order and most importantly, creating new formations and new relationships between them. That's what that chapter is really about. Before you've even gotten to the end of the war. And what Foner does is he basically goes through the North and the South and examines the ways that the different broad social groupings of the North and the South have been changed by the war, starting, of course, with the slaves, who by 1863 had begun in huge numbers to resist plantation authority, to flee to Union lines whenever they have a chance, and to, in general, withdraw their labor from the Confederate war effort. This is what Du Bois, I know, calls in his book General Strike. That's how he frames it. And that what Foner is getting at here, most importantly, is that this is an assertion in the context of the war of like black freedom and an assertion of black rights and a demand for not only the end of slavery but the end of the social caste system that had emerged and. On the other hand, the non-plantation-owning white population of the South, at the same time that this was happening, at the same time as slaves were sort of rebelling and resisting slavery and aiding the Union Army, the upcountry, as they're known, Southern whites, the poor subsistence, largely subsistence farmers of the Appalachians, but and essentially anywhere of mountainous terrain where plantation agriculture and the hegemonic culture that plantation agriculture created couldn't sustain itself. And in those places, resistance to the Confederacy was always relatively high and got higher over the course of the war as the Confederacy asked more and more of smallholders, of poor whites, and less of the rich plantation owner class. The South instituted a draft before the North did. It exempted, before the North it had its $100 man policy, it exempted owners of slaves, I believe more than 20 slaves, from conscription. And most interestingly and importantly, I think, the interests of individual slave owners came to conflict with the interests of the Confederate cause, because there was money to be made from dealing cotton and other materials to the Yankee invader, which was too much of a temptation for many southern plantation owners to resist. Meanwhile, the poor upcountry whites were the vast majority of the military They were the cannon fodder of the war, and they were also asked to pay the lion's share of taxation and suffer the most, the ones who stayed home, due to shortages in food. There were bread riots throughout the South. There's the most famous one was in Richmond, but they were all over the South. And this led to wide-scale sabotage, draft resistance, and union sentiment in the upcountry of the South. Now, that did not translate to some sort of solidarity with slavery, with slaves, because in many cases, upcountry Southerners blamed blacks for slavery as much as they blamed the owners of blacks for slavery. And I just, there's one quote from that Foner puts in here from a Methodist circuit riding preacher in eastern Tennessee, which was a hotbed of anti-Confederate sentiment because it was mountainous. And in fact, if it hadn't been for the quick deployment of Confederate troops to root out Unionist sentiment and hang Unionist leaders, there's a good chance that eastern Tennessee could have seceded from Tennessee the same way that western Virginia did earlier in the war. Which, by the way, West Virginia being able to secede from the Confederacy and become its own state, that was the one site of the war where McClellan was able to distinguish himself at all. That's where he got his early reputation, was in securing Western Virginia, which allowed it to secede from the Confederacy. That could have happened in eastern Tennessee, except for the Confederate Army, which came in and started hanging people without due process because they love liberty so much. But what this preacher, this anti-Confederate pro-Union preacher, William Brownlow, said that he wished to arm every wolf, panther, catamount, and bear in the mountains of America, every rattlesnake and crocodile, every devil in hell, and turn them loose upon the Confederacy. And that's the way that, like, people who now all have Confederate fucking flag shit on their houses and on their shirts and stuff, that's how people at that point felt about the Confederacy. Because you're always most aware of the exploitation being perpetrated by those nearest you. And that hostility between the upcountry and the plantation regions, that had predated the war, and it was exacerbated and intensified by the war. And Foner notes this just to say once again that this is a moment of profound friction and conflict and change. The relationship people have to their government, to the institutions that they have taken for granted, is in flux. And then in the North, Foner talks about the way that anti-union sentiment was to be found not only among the butternut regions of southern Ohio and Illinois and Indiana, which were filled with people who had migrated from Tennessee and Kentucky and Virginia and who had slave sympathies, slavery sympathies, but also among the urban Irish immigrants. And the draft riot of 1863 is a big example of that. And in this case, you have people who are being asked to fight for a union that they do not feel that they are being benefited by, that and to defeat a system that they do not find to be a threat to them. And there is one interesting distinction, though, which is that while the Northern, while the Confederate elite found themselves in a situation where their narrow self-interest was often in conflict with the collective interest of the Confederacy, the Confederate project. In the North, being, if you had access to capital and you were in any way in industry, your self-interest was in fully supporting the labor, the war effort, because that's where the money came from. The Northern economy was completely revolutionized by the injection of a vast amount of liquid currency, fiat currency, into the economic system in a country which had not had at any point before that a national currency. That's the thing to remember, is that before the Civil War, there was not a lot of currency in circulation in a lot of parts of this country, especially farther away from cities. And places where there was currency, it was issued by banks, which had charters from the government allowing them to issue currency backed by a reserve of gold that they held. And in order to fight the war, the United States created the greenbacks, which were backed by nothing other than America's force, and which created an explosion of economic activity. It was incredibly beneficial to northern agriculture, but was and also was very beneficial to people who held debt, who were in debt to financial institutions, because they could pay back with cheap money that which they borrowed with dear money. But for workers, for that burgeoning class of wage laborers, inflation cut into their actual income. They saw a real drop in real wages over the course of the war, which was one of the things that exacerbated hostility to the war effort itself. And so, in pointing this out, Foner is saying these systems are in flux, and more than anything, we are seeing one system be destroyed and another victorious. The contradictions within them both contributing to their victory and to the defeat. And if anybody, I mean, honestly, I don't think there's any case to be made that there is a moral, that you could say that there is a moral superiority in any sense to the Jeffersonian small government model as it ended up being practiced in the South. Because one of the big things that kept those poor whites so poor is that there was very little taxation or infrastructure or public education of any kind in the South, which is one of the things that actually paradoxically allowed for the tension between poor whites and plantation economy to remain latent, was because not a lot was asked of poor people. There was very little taxation in the first place. And that allowed the state to sort of be seen as, you know, not an interdicting fact in people's lives. But the reality of that then ended up being that people were stuck in a pretty much a permanent condition of poverty that they could not overcome, that the ladder of improvement that like the Whiggish model in the North allowed for was totally off the chart, off the table for poor Southern whites. But that was not, because it was not the result of explicit policy, but rather the lack of policy, it was not necessarily directly tied to tied in the minds of, you know, poor whites to the state itself, to the powers itself. That changed, though, when taxes started going up to pay for the war and conscription started to send people to fight the war. And then in the North, you have this new industrial economy spinning up into existence in order to fight the war and defeat the Confederacy. And in so doing, creating, one, the huge expansion of the concept of rights, the concept of liberty in America, in a positive direction, instead of the notion of, you know, negative rights that had predominated in the constitutional, in the early federal era, because of, you know, the fact that there was a war on that was, over the course of the war, more and more identified with the cause of human freedom. But to fight that war and to win that war and to create an economy that could do so, it ended up concentrating economic power in the halls of finance and among this new class of captains of industry, these new industrial leaders, and who would use that power to guarantee, to assert, assure the, for themselves, that whatever political reality emerged from the war, it would be one that would take as its basic premise the inviolability of private property, the inviolability of the financial sector, and of the wage relationship. More than anything, Foner in this chapter is saying that, is pointing out the points of friction, conflict, and opportunity. And I think, more than anything, emphasizing the fluidity of the situation. And that fluidity, which in retrospect can often appear to be predetermined, because you look at a situation and it often does become difficult to see where anything different could have happened. But the reality of the war is that so many established forms were breaking up that that what came after was really contingent. And over the course of the book, we're going to find out exactly how those contingencies solidified into reality. But I was off track for a second. I was talking about how I don't think there is a moral, there's no argument you can make morally that the plantation system that emerged in the South out of the Jeffersonian notion of small government was in any way superior to the Northern Federalist / Whig notion of internal improvements and central authority. So if there is no moral superiority there, and even like stipulating, let's stipulate that the Federalist free system isn't even better. I mean, I don't think that's true. I think if you have slavery in your system, it's inherently worse. But forget that. Say they're fine. Or say they're equivalently immoral because they're equivalent in that they are systems of class oppression. They are systems of extraction of surplus from one group of people for the enjoyment of another. That's the case in both systems. The mechanisms, the social forms are different, but that's the reality of both of them. And then they went to war with one another. And one of them, at every point, all of the things that were supposed to be virtues of the system ended up undermining the ability of the state to defend itself. Whereas in the North, every element of the system combined to make this system into a more effective fighting force, into a more effective defender and exerter of its state prerogative. And if morals are out of the door, then the which one was better, to me, is solved. Hamilton was right. Jefferson was wrong. The Civil War proved it. You can't say one was morally superior to another, or that one system had a superior respect for individual freedom or rights or liberty or any of that bullshit. Neither of them did. They're both systems of securing class rule. One of them secured it effectively, one of them secured it hilariously ineffectively, and was essentially subsidized by the other until it could no longer sustain it, until that relationship couldn't sustain itself, at which point it was destroyed by the other. But that conflict had to be resolved through force, because both sides had enough access to land and enough access to capital to build essentially competing social structures within a fantasy of a national government, which had a constitutional system that was designed to sublimate conflict until it could no longer be sublimated any longer, at which point conflict became overt, and boom, the North won. Did Larry Flint really die? Damn. R.I.P. R.I.P. to a real one. Are they going to roll his dead ass into a volcano or something? That'd be pretty funny. So if anybody has any questions about what was in the first chapter, we could go over them a little bit. Otherwise, we'll really get into it, I think, next week. I'm going to do two chapters, and I'm going to, for that one, I'm going to like take notes and everything and go through them. This time I didn't really do that. The thing about the American system is that it is designed to sublimate all, I mean, and this is true of all democratic governing deliberative institutions is that they are designed to mystify and baffle and sublimate conflict away from reality and into sort of performance. But the ability to keep doing that is really just predicated on, it's not predicated on anything intrinsic to the system. It's not predicated on the values that the system inculcates. It's premised on the ability of the system to ameliorate conflict materially. And in America, that has always been the ability to offload issues, offload social conflict through the assimilation of land and the distribution of resources through expropriation here and then globally. That's been always it. And the current conflict we are in is that we have reached a point of where expropriation has become diminishing, where we have a diminishing returns for expropriation, and that means that the latent conflict is reemerging. And the Civil War was a similar situation. The only way to ameliorate the conflict between the northern and southern modes of production was continued expansion on the terms of the South, but that over time became too existentially threatening to the northern political system and economic system. That's why I often wonder if the Whigs had gotten in there after William Henry Harrison had died, say William Henry Clay becomes president instead of John Tyler, and you have a Whig government in the aftermath of the 1837 panic, sort of reorienting politics away from expansion and towards internal improvement, that perhaps you don't have that headlong dash to the Pacific and the eventual annihilation of the South. I don't know. Someone says the slavery was the only system that could make the South economically competitive with the North. That is true, because it's the land that allows for massive profit through the sale of cash crops. But the thing is, why the fuck are they competing? It's one country. The whole notion of them being in competition arose from the historical accident of the states coming in as sort of equals, rather than as it emerging as a whole political unit. But regional conflict between regional ruling classes has to at some point be sublimated. And that was the project of European centralization, the creation of the creation of the absolutist monarch model of like the early modern era, you know, like Louis XIV. That was not at the expense of like the regular French citizens. It was at the expense of local barons. It was at the expense of regional power. And that was true everywhere that that centralized authority emerged in Europe. How radical were the German immigrants in Missouri during the war and Reconstruction? They were certainly more radical than the fucking regular white people who lived in Missouri, that's for sure. The Germans were responsible for Missouri staying in the Union. It was German militia that drove the pro-secession forces out of St. Louis at the beginning of the war and denied them the ability to join the Confederacy in the first place. And yeah, the German immigrants of Missouri, but also Ohio, Wisconsin, they were Pennsylvania. They were more class conscious, certainly, than native-born northern forces for the most part, because many of them had come from, they had fled, like absolutism, and specifically, a lot of them had fled the destruction of like the artisan class by the Industrial Revolution. And he came to America to try to reassert like artisan rights, which put them in conscious conflict not just Eastern banks, but also large landowners. Like, part of the problem of class consciousness, or at least as the conflict of the part of the problem of native white Americans seeing the slave power for what it was, is that they did not have that that instinctive conflict with large landowners in the South. Northerners didn't, anyway. Like, they might have seen slavery as a competing labor system, but they did not see themselves in any way as personally oppressed by the large landowners of the South. Whereas for a lot of these Germans, when they saw the big landowners of the South, they thought of the Junkers. They thought of the Junkers of Prussia, who overweened the German Confederation at that point, and were an occupying foreign force in most of the Rhineland, which is where many of the German Catholic immigrants came from. So when they saw the fancy lads and with their dueling and their fake Walter Scott cosplay, they saw the face of their own exploitation and their own alienation. Fuck you, I'll pronounce it how I want. Junker? That's stupid. I'm an American, I'm calling it Junker. Kick you in the Junker. There's no such thing as native white Americans? Okay, tell that to them. Good God, get out of here. Give me a break. We're talking about like self communities through their own self-conception. They thought of themselves as Americans. Yes, Muncher with Baron von Munchausen. I haven't read the new Matt Karp article yet. I'm looking forward to it. His election analysis is always absolute fire, so I'm sure it'll be great. I don't actually... Someone asked about the counterfactual 1848. That's not one where I really feel like there was a lot of possibilities outside of what actually happened. That was... Really, that's why would I have read that? Because it was a movement of people who had no common cause, that there was no unity at all, and you can't even say that unity could have come through struggle the way that it might have happened and was happening to some degree through the course of the Civil War. Because there was no struggle to unify through. It was always piecemeal, haphazard, spontaneous, unmarshaled and unled. And it was a continent-wide emergence of, more than anything, bourgeois insistence upon like the liberal state. And as that meant a lot of coalition building with like early forms of working class organization. But once again, the working class in practice was still very much in its infancy at that point in Europe. The majority of workers who rebelled in the cities of Europe during 1848 were not wage workers, per se. They were mostly artisans who were being squeezed by the imposition of free trade and the concentration of capital, which was early but was still pressing them. It was essentially a combination of a new urban small bourgeois fighting with a sort of pre-capitalist allying with a pre-capitalist artisan class. And on an ad hoc basis, mostly organized around questions of nationalism and language. And in such a situation, I really don't think that there are way too many things that would have to go drastically differently in order to have the overall contours of that event change in any significant way. Well, the idea that the American Revolutionary War was the second English Civil War. Kevin Phillips talks about that in a really interesting book called The Cousins War, where he essentially says that the English Civil War, the Revolutionary War, and the Civil War are all one long conflict in the Anglosphere between landowners, a feudal landowning ruling class, and an emergent merchant middle class, which would eventually take over from feudalism. And that those three wars are essentially the wars that, over the course of those 300 years, saw feudalism fully overthrown and replaced by capitalism. And I think that there's a lot to that. And his main argument is that the social basis of the two sides in all three of those wars is basically the same. The English Civil War, obviously, you can't say that this is true completely. You know, there were examples, there were counterexamples on each side, but it was broadly a battle between emergent urban merchants and big landowners. The roundheads, the Puritan side, were city dwellers, were merchants, and the cavaliers were the large feudal landowning class. Then the Revolutionary War is essentially a battle between the most industrious and most religiously effusive of those merchants going to the United States, creating essentially their own country, and then going to war with a homeland that was still largely controlled within itself by the large landowning old feudal order. Although, of course, there were plenty of, you know, the Whigs at that point were already like the merchant party. They were the urban party within there. And they were, by the way, the people who were most likely to be sympathetic to the United States. William Pitt, whose Pittsburgh is named after, was a Whig politician who supported the colonists. And then the Civil War is, of course, the culmination of that on the home, fully in the United States. And here you have the neo-feudal attempt was essentially in the South to recreate the old feudal order in the New World, conflicting with the merchant state, the industrial merchant state of the North. And like these battles are a war in the place where capitalism is emerging in its like most effective and durable form, out of sort of a feudal loam. But that process is not a fast or decisive one. It is a dialectical process. It is existing forms of power negotiating with emergent forms of power through politics, and when politics fails, through warfare. But at every point, the victory was won by capitalists at the expense of the feudal order. And by the end of it, the feudal order had been broken. The neo-feudal guys in the revolution did not mostly side with the revolution. That's not true. The reason that Cornwall marched south after they took New York is because there was much more loyalist sympathy in the South amongst the large landowners. Now, guys like Washington and Jefferson, of course, were pro-revolution, but that was not true broadly among the large landowning class in the South. They tended to be more loyal, more Tory. Guys like Washington, the reason that they were for the union is because, have you ever noticed it's mostly guys from Virginia, the state that's closest to the northern merchant capitals, that's whose economies are most tied in there. Those were the people who were the most, who were the large landowners of the South, who were most likely to support the Patriot side. Washington, George Washington, was a even though he was a landowner, he had the mind of a fucking merchant. He was, his entire life was consumed with the notion of advancement, of social and monetary success, which are antithetical values to the decadent land-based urban ruling elite, who were beaten largely because their social order looked down upon the sort of striving that people like Washington made their lives around. And part of the, and the reason for that is that Washington did not come from a large, from a family of huge, like, noble birth. He came from a middling class of landowners and clergy, actually, who came to America and immediately started grinding. He was from a long line of grinders, which is not true of the, a lot of the large landowners of the South who supported supported the king. And the thing that in that book, by the way, that will, that Phillips gets really into, that reflects what Fonner's talking about, is that in every region there was a conflict between upcountry poor settlers and the settled, like Delta plantation region settlers, and wherever, and who had, whatever the politics of the elite were, the upcountry poors had the opposite. So wherever there was hegemonic support for the patriot cause among the local elite, the local smallholders and poor people, poor whites, were Tories. And wherever the large landowners and large elites were Tories, the local smallholders and poor people were patriots. And the challenge that Reconstruction presented was the challenge of knitting together these dispossessed groups into a political coalition. And that did not happen. And the fact that it didn't happen is why the Yankee Leviathan ended up becoming completely captured by the emerging industrial robber baron elite. Yeah, so that's the other thing about Virginia, is that it was the largest of the colonies in population. And it was also very interested in expansion westward, which put it in direct competition with England after the 1763 proclamation, which forbade settlement beyond the Appalachians. And guys like George Washington had direct financial interest in seeing those lands explored, settled, and sold, because land speculation was a huge potential revenue source. Oh, the impeachment trial. Who fucking gives a shit? Why or how could you care? And I understand that some people hear you say that and they think, oh, you're being an edgelord, you're not taking it seriously enough. And I understand, I don't want to feel like, oh, it's not a big deal. It was pretty fucking wild when people rushed the Senate. And, like, that is kind of wild that that happened. And that the president told people to do it. That is a new shift. That's a new phase. I understand that. But this particular thing, this particular process, the impeachment trial after the guy's out of office, it really does feel like, more than anything, it is a emotional pressure release. It is a way for people to have their feelings validated and go through their trauma and then sort of heal about it. And if you want to do that, if you have the trauma and you feel like that's helpful, that's fine. And if you feel like watching this helps you do that, that's fine. But expecting anybody who does not feel that trauma, that they have to join with you in this spectacle, that's what I don't understand. And that's where I refuse to go along with it. Because everyone knows what's going to happen. There is no amount of eloquence, there is no amount of persuasive evidence that could be presented that will get a conviction out of this process. There are not enough Republicans who want to lose their next election, basically, and so they're not going to do it. They will not happen. And with that in mind, I honestly wonder for a lot of these people who insist that this is a very important thing, don't you worry about that fact? Don't you worry about the fact that this horrible transgression is going to go down in history as having been validated by the deliberative process of the Senate? The only way this thing makes sense as a political project is if you are really convinced that that Capitol breach is going to be the thing that destroys the Republican Party. That the center of gravity of American politics is going to shift away from Republicans because they refused to condemn this thing fully. And I think that's the only kind of, that's the kind of thing you can only believe if you really do live in a bubble. If you, and of course, no one is more bubbled than these fucking dipshits in Washington. And more, and I think even more importantly, nobody is more invested in shifting politics away from real stakes and material interests than the Democrats either. Capitalism did replace feudalism, not in the sense that, because people are pointing out, like, we're going towards something that is going to be neo-feudalist, techno-feudalism, and doesn't that mean that feudalism never went away? A mode of production is a bunch of things. It's a bunch of social concepts. And the thing is that feudalism had at its social base an understanding of the world that is not the same as capitalism. The liberal subjectivity is not feudal. It is different. And so since now liberal subjectivity is hegemonic, feudalism is gone. Now, if capitalism is replaced with this system of like feudal obligations enforced through technological means, not through social means, you could say that, like, as a mere mechanism of extraction, that you have something that resembles feudalism, but its social basis is completely different. The undergirding social logic is one of capitalist individualism. And to say that, and that means, and so whatever comes out of that will maintain that social reality. I mean, if you really want to go back far enough, like, it's always been a war between masters and servants, and masters have always won. Like, the masters have always won. The only thing that changes is the rationale and conditions and social basis of that mastery. Like, when the bourgeois overthrew capitalism, it was not liberation. It was not human liberation. It was not the subject being liberated. It was one group of rulers being replaced with another, and a new justification for their rule. Was there anything progressive about the American Revolution? Yes. Like, it's, you cannot have the possibility for socialism until you have capitalism first, demolishing the feudal order. Right, socialism is a shadow form of capitalism. It is only conceivable in the real context of capitalism and capitalist relations that allows socialism to emerge as a conception. Like the freedom of like the liberation of a feudal order, of a pre-industrial feudal order, is essentially a regression to tribal self-sufficiency. And then capitalism gives birth to socialism as a culmination. Well, see, that's the thing about Russia and China is that they really weren't supposed to be where socialist revolution happened. They really weren't modern capitalist societies that had reached a point of contradiction that could be resolved through socialism. Yeah, like I'm more and more come to the idea that I kind of think that once the German Revolution failed, the Bolsheviks should have made a deal with the peasants. I think maybe Bukharin was right in the whole debate about what to do about industrialization and what to do about the peasantry. Because the entire premise of the Bolshevik Revolution had been as the opening act of a world revolution. Yeah, but would World War II have happened the same way? See, there was no, when Bukharin was arguing for this stuff, the Nazis didn't exist yet. They were not in charge. Like you're looking back through the lens and saying, yes, but they needed to do all that to win World War II. That's not historically grounded. That's trying to like pick a side and win an argument. Yeah, it's like people love to give the Soviets credit for beating the Nazis, but they essentially handed the keys of the world over to the United States, who were where the Nazis got all their ideas from. Explicitly, Hitler would looked at Manifest Destiny and was taking notes the whole time. Thing is that there's nothing that's inevitable. Nothing is inevitable. In retrospect, when things have solidified into history, you can see why maybe something else couldn't have happened. But those superpositions don't solidify until the moment of action, until things occur that can be looked back on. So, like, the degree to which people turn Marxism into a teleology of inevitable victory, which I think honestly is more of a 20th century thing than a thing people still think. That was a way to justify themselves, to justify their actions, to justify their adherence to a regime as like the sole repository of, like of socialism as a project. There's no inevitability to any of this. But there is within capitalism, there is the potential for socialism. That's just the fact. That's the truth. And then you have to analyze that question. And okay, if that's true and socialism is superior, then how do we fucking get there? You cannot assume the inevitability of anything. They didn't have the specter of catastrophic climate collapse, but they did have a real belief that they were all going to get killed in a nuclear war. People forget that. Like people who want to be doom-pilled now about like climate, there was for the among educated people in the all of the world, there was a very strong belief that any given day a nuclear war might happen that would destroy all life on Earth. And that now is so receded into the backdrop of people's minds and been replaced with climate doomerism that the fact that this thing that was very close, I mean, it wasn't just the Cuban Missile Crisis. There's Abel Archer. There were two Soviet military officers who had it in their hands to cause a nuclear war, once during Once in the 80s and once during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And both times they said no. And their human decision is what saved humanity. It was nothing having to do with our systems of mutually assured destruction and our beautifully crafted defense doctrines. It was human choice. It was human agency in the moment. That's how fluid and how contingent things are. Petrov. And of course, it could happen. And honestly, it'd be kind of funny if we end up getting a nuclear war anyway due to climate change conflict. That's totally possible. But that sure as shit wasn't what people in like 1963 were thinking was going to happen. I think I'm just saying that to say that basing your actions in the present on an assumed social outcome, either good or bad, in the future, is always going to just end up being, in practice, self-indulgence. Because you're not responding to reality, you're making a reality to operate off of. And the question is, what are you making that reality for? And I think if you're assuming annihilation, the only reason that you would want to make that reality and live as that reality is if you want an excuse to not do things that are difficult, to not sacrifice, to not build your spirit, because what's the point? But every day you do that and you're still here, you're hurting yourself and everyone around you. We are, in fact, already dead. I mean, like, we all died already. Like, your life, in the grand scheme of things, is a round down to zero. Like, it's already happened. And this society is already dead. But what comes after it is not known. It can't be known. It's not blackpilled. God damn it. I'm saying you can't know. You cannot know. But if you sell yourself, you do. It's not because you've studied everything and you've come to the correct conclusion. Because you don't have enough information. Nobody has that information. That information is not accessible. No matter how much the fantasy of online, of the information superhighway and spinning around the world, and the idea that you can reach out and grab all the knowledge and pull it onto yourself. Even if you could do that, you still have to sort it. You still have to prioritize it. And those choices are not being made objectively. They're being made from either love, either from a desire to see love expressed in the world, or out of a desire to selfishly maintain a life of indulgence. Whatever that means, because, you know, it can be miserable, but it can be a misery that is familiar and therefore soothing and comforting. Oh, and on this, somebody asked about antinatalism. I'm fully against that. You have to believe in a future, even if it's not going to happen. You have to believe in a future. If you don't want kids, fucking, because you don't like the idea of sacrificing time for someone else, okay. But acting like you're doing them a favor by not bringing it into the world is bullshit. I'm sorry. Yeah, First Reformed is a great film and a movie I didn't really appreciate as much when I first saw it because of how enmeshed I was in the very pathologies that Ethan Hawke's character presents. Like, he's going to blow up the Koch brothers, but not because it's going to make anything better. It's because he wants to go out on his own terms. It's because he has given up on connecting to anyone or anything outside of himself. But of course, that doesn't mean anyone is obligated to have kids. Like fucking freaks, psychos like Raus Douthat think. But if the choice needs to be, it needs to be interrogated at the personal level, not fobbed off on some cack-handed and self-serving analysis of the geopolitical world or the amount of fucking carbon in the atmosphere. That's made up. That's not real. Carbon is not made up, but your idea of what's going to happen is made up. I'm sorry. Has to be. You don't know as much as you think you do. I don't. None of us do. Besides, we might not even have to worry about the question of having kids if that shit about fucking, like, plastic fucking up endocrine systems if that keeps happening at the rate it is, then you won't even have to make the choice. Everyone will just be sterilized, Children of Men style. And then, hey, that'll solve global warming. So, then what were you worried about? Because, like, there you go. There's two things that you can look at the data, and they're both very compelling cases for human extinguishment through climate change, and also the fact that we might not be able to reproduce in 20 years because everybody's balls are filled with fucking microplastic. Both very compelling. You can fixate on both of them. You can't know either way, and they conflict with one another. One of them could solve the other problem. Either way, you still gotta fucking live. You still gotta be alive. Nobody should be telling people to have children or not have children. That's weird. What? Who are you? Shut the fuck up. That's just a weird thing to make political. And it speaks more to some sort of psychosexual thing, honestly, or a compensatory thing. Than any real, earnest, good faith engagement with politics. Now, then maybe the garbage, the algae bloom will eat all the CO2. You don't know. I think the most important thing to just remember about all that stuff is that you cannot filter your underlying spiritual attitude, your underlying matrix of reward from your analysis. All right, I'm going to wrap it up. So next week, we're going to read the next two chapters 2 and 3 of Reconstruction. I will have some notes next time, which I didn't do this time. Sorry about that. So we're going to go through it because I'm reading it on my phone, actually. I've got the Kindle app on my phone, which means I can't look at it when I'm talking here. So I'm going to have to start taking notes. A thing I didn't really realize until today, which, my bad. But so, chapters 2 and 3 for next week. Reconstruction by Eric Foner. Bye-bye.